We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. This is a pre-recording of a Twitter Spaces live event that we hosted. If you'd like to be a part of the next one, go on to Twitter /Palisades Radio, and you can be part of the conversation. You can listen to our conversation on the desktop, but it works better on the mobile app. Just as a reminder, as always, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as Odyssey if you don't enjoy using YouTube. I hope you enjoy it and hope to see you on the next one.
Everyone, welcome to the, let's call it the silver space for today. Just waiting for David to come in as a speaker here. Bob, what's on your mind here at the beginning of this week?
I guess we could kind of go through, there's a lot of, I guess with the derivative structure, the derivative reporting through Office of Comptroller Currency, we finally figured out actually why you had a huge jump the first quarter of 2022 in the precious metals category. It looked like it wasn't just simply a bank selling a bunch of different derivative products. It was actually gold being actually moved via accounting method or accounting from the exchange rate provisions over to the precious metals category. And that big jump actually is what it just wasn't reported in the call reports. It would have been nice if the OCC would have told us back then, but they waited till the quarterly report to put the footnote in there. So that kind of explained the big jump, because I couldn't figure out why you'd have a tenfold increase in silver, platinum, and palladium just out of the blue. So that kind of helped explain a little bit of that fiasco, I guess you could say. Now to break,
yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, to break out, you know, the gold section via the, it may be a little bit harder to do. I guess you could, you know, run a spreadsheet and try to back in some numbers and that type of thing. But I don't know if it means as much. I mean, there's been not to get into the weeds, but there's been some changes in some of the because of Basel III, the reporting requirements, moving from a current exposure method of accounting to a standardized approach for counterparty credit risk. So basically, it's just a different way that Basel forces banks to account for these derivative transactions. But not to get – I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, because that's – I still am trying to understand everything about – these two accounting methods and, you know, using cash flows versus actual counterparty risk and throwing in there, you know, mixing in some margin and some other good stuff. So, but just the overall was just simply at, you know, I guess the big takeaway is just that gold was being added or switched in categories. So
go ahead, David.
I'd like to ask a little bit more. Thanks for the explanation. I'm looking at the graphic right now. What I found interesting, Bob, and like a comment, Tom's as well, if you want, is that the big orange stripe is 1 year or less, which I would say is a hedge. And then the 1 to 5 years is the blue, which is substantially more than before because they changed the requirement. And then the 5 years or greater, I don't even see it. So, you know, if I was trying to be objective and looking at this, I'd say, yeah, that's mostly hedges. Now, not that it doesn't, you know, affect the market, obviously, but what are your thoughts on that, Bob?
It's interesting because we can go down this rabbit hole, because one of the things I was posting this morning was the – and I talked about it a couple weeks ago or a few weeks ago, I think. It was these ETNs and ETPs and – or ETCs, I'm sorry, the exchange-traded commodities or exchange-traded notes, ETNs. And the reason why I think a lot of this stuff is within 1 year in terms of maturity, it's not that – It's not that these are just less than a year products. I think it's because of the callable feature that a lot of these derivative products have on them, because a lot of this stuff has absolutely nothing to do with the metal itself. These are all maybe indexing products, or they have some type of income component feature utilizing, you know, covered call writing, for example, or, you know, they take 80% of the portfolio and throw it into, you know, treasuries, and then they wrap either futures contracts, buy or sell, or options on the buy and sell side to mirror some type of silver performance. So they use some type of leveraged strategy, which that can actually start this huge rabbit hole discussion if you want to go down there in terms of, you know, I posted like the, you know, this DB Silver Fund, Deutsche Bank Silver Fund, or this Credit Suisse Silver Fund. And, you know, these things are, I know I posted the chart on my, maybe I could bring it into the nest, I guess, but, you know, the Credit Suisse one is down like 76% on a non-dividend reporting or non-total return basis. But when you throw in the dividends in there, it still has lost money. And not only that, the dividends that are paid are also taxable, so you don't have that accounting for in the total return chart, you know, in terms of tax exposure. So some of these funds are they're really just products developed by Wall Street to basically enrich Wall Street. And, you know, in my opinion, from a long term perspective, you know, these things are not designed to be long term vehicles. They're maybe good short term strategies, maybe as an institution saying wanting some type of exposure to commodities, but they do it through some type of wrap product. But over the long haul, these things are just money losers. I mean, I don't see any purpose of, you know, creating a covered call strategy when the principal of the trade is going down 76% and you're reliant on these covered calls to try and squeak out some type of return. And that's not always guaranteed either. So
I want to stay here just a little longer. I definitely want to move on, but you said a mouthful and then some, but I want to just bring it back to the KISS principle, keep it simple and sincere. So let me kind of give a layman's view of what you said, maybe a move on. But if we remember the movie The Big Short, and most people that are listening to this would have seen the movie, and when we're looking at the blackjack table and you got the two players going against the dealer and a couple of other players there, and then there's people standing behind them making a bet on their bet, and then there's a bet on the bet that the second party has made, then there's a bet on the bet that the third party has made, and it goes on and on. For quite some time, I was talking about the credit default swaps and CDO Square doing it a couple more times, et cetera. So I think that's sort of an analogy, not a real crystal clear direct relationship. But these things, as you said, Bob, and this is what I want to clarify, is that people have look at that and say, oh, this is all gold, silver, platinum related, and gold's a separate something else they report separately. And without knowing what you just verbalized, people would assume that it's pretty simple to understand, and it's not. It's very complicated. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. To say it's complicated, yeah, understatement. The problem that silver has, and I think you know this as well as anybody, is that silver is sort of like the hot potato. It's always being hedged somehow, whether you're a mine mining it out of the ground, and then it moves to a refiner or a smelter, and then it's then moved down the chain to a fabricator or to a wholesaler. At any point in the time, somebody's always, you know, they take the physical product, but then they short a futures contract or, you know, some type of vehicle that provides them paper, try to neutralize the paper risk, I guess, the price risk, you could say. So silver is constantly being shorted on the, say, for example, the COMEX. It's a natural selling market. And so that 1 ounce of silver that comes out of the ground may be shorted five different times in its history, ultimately to its end user, where it kind of sits in, you know, either in a vault or someone's basement or wherever it may be. But that's part of the frustrating ordeal that I think we see as silver users, is that our pricing mechanism, the price setter, is really an exchange that's derived or created for hedging purposes. And that makes it very, very frustrating, I think, for our community.
Agree. I'll make a comment. We probably could definitely move on, but I mean, it's done with the dealers all the time. When, you know, you get an order for X amount of tons of silver, you're going to hedge it. You can't afford not to. Same thing with a retail dealer like Miles Franklin or goldsilver.com or any of these people out there that work in the precious metals industry, retail or wholesale. And so you see this big increase. Oh, they're shorting the hell out of it. They're taking the price down. Some of that's true. I wrote a whole chapter about it. But on aggregate, if you take the big picture, you know, some of it's because there's a lot of buying going on. So we might leave it there, Bob. You can have the final word. I'd like to just take some questions that have come in and some other comments.
Yeah, no, definitely. We could jump to the questions.
Just like to add one thing, David, there to what Bob was saying. It's not necessarily that it's shorted as certain people understand that in the market. It is hedged in a lot of cases, which is equivalent to a short, and it doesn't mean it's necessarily malicious, right?
Could I add one thing, please?
Sure. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. Different examples don't always mean a short hedge, that the hedge is a short. Mr. Morgan just mentioned to Bob, he said, if you've got a big order come in, let's say a $500,000 order, Bob's natural hedge to that would be to go long. So the price, before he filled the order, the price didn't get away from him upside. Bob doesn't care after he takes the order if the price goes down. He cares if the price goes up. I just want to interject that a hedge can be long or short. It's not always short.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a very good point. All right. Well, looking through some of the feedback I've gotten from my Twitter account, one of the questions I get the most often is, what will happen to gold and silver if we have a huge sell-off in the general stock market? And the answer is they will go down. That's at least been the recent history, meaning, you know, my lifetime. And they usually start off falling, but usually not as far. I think 2008 is a great example. When the financial crisis emerged, housing got creamed, stock market fell, gold went down 30%, and silver lost more than 50%. However, gold was the first to recover, and the miners. The miners went down with the gold, but they recovered, and gold went from that low, and it more than doubled, and the miners did better because they're leveraged. Silver, on the other hand, actually went up about fivefold. It went from roughly a $9 level all the way up to close to 50. And the other thing I like to point out, the 2008 bottom, is that the retail market was similar at that time to where we are now, meaning extremely high premiums. Unless you were buying direct off the exchange or knew a wholesaler that had commercial bars, you were paying like $13 an ounce for silver when the paper price was $9. I actually took advantage of that. I bought three 1,000-ounce bars and minted my own rounds, but that's kind of, I digress. So looking now, we have silver and gold off. They're not doing what we think they should be doing at this moment in time. I believe longer term, they'll do exactly what we expect as far as a contra investment to what the bond and the stocks are doing. But they're getting their feet. What I find interesting is looking at how far down gold has gone versus what it did in 2008. It's acting much stronger than it was then. Same thing with silver. And that indicates to me that possibly we're in a situation where the metals are looking into the future and seeing that this next crisis is going to be far worse than the 2008. Of course, that's a personal belief of mine. So I'll leave it there. Bob or Jim or anyone want to comment?
Yeah, well, I would just say I think the market, the metals are trying to anticipate, again, will the Fed relent before they get inflation under control? Meaning, will the markets go down enough, force their hand, and with this sort of so-called tightening that they're doing, basically they can only tighten so much, and that puts just enormous pressure on just a number of different avenues. I mean, one thing, I think it's important to measure, not that the metals are hypothecated and leveraged and so forth, but U.S. Treasuries are also looked at as collateral. And for example, if a hedge fund has a treasury note or T-bill, whatever it may be, you know, they may need money. They may use the treasury as collateral and give that to a dealer and get money for that. And then that dealer may take that exact same treasury and then sell it to or give it to a money market fund. And so that same treasury has been moved around the pie several different times. And so that's the problem we have in the system is once you start to see a dislocation, you know, this whole thing could come unraveled very quickly.
Indeed.
I'd like to add something. I spoke actually with Rick Rule this morning, just to kind of give you a bit of his perspective about what he thinks needs to happen for gold and silver to move. He's not even necessarily counting on, let's say, the actual downfall of the US dollar, you know, seeing it lose its reserve currency status. If you look at it from the perspective of having just a mean reversion of the last 40 years back to that 2%, and he said in his heart of hearts, he believes it will overshoot, but back to that mean 2% average weighting in a portfolio or for most US investors, that would be enough to bring, you know, trillions of new dollars into the space.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Tom, and I'll add on to that. I put it on my Twitter feed, I think about a week ago. Sorry, folks, old age, I can't remember the title, but it was a video that Mike Maloney made, again, 4 years ago, and it was the 10 reasons to buy gold and silver, and he changed it. His staff wrote it up. It was well done, but he scratched out the 10 reasons and put the 10 reasons I buy gold and silver. And in that, he made the point that with the internet, the ability of people to buy gold and silver online, these are things that we did not experience in the 1972, 1980 bull run. And now it's available for everyone. So his idea, and adds on to what you just discussed with Rick, is that when this run to gold starts in a meaningful way for the public, and there'll be institutions as well. I mean, a lot of institutions will be looking at their bond portfolio and say, what could I do? And they'll see what gold's doing. They'll say, well, we could get a gold position. So I really think that we are not thinking that through all the way, because it's my belief that we will see an unbelievable amount. So instead of going to the standard 2%, we may get to 4% or higher. And if that were to occur, paper price on these metals would be significant.
Anything to add there, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, you always have those arguments with, I mean, you hear it in a lot of different asset classes. It's, I'm kind of one that just watches the market and the trends. And if that move does come, it's great, but it's obviously I hate to anticipate something like that because it's a very difficult thing to try and, you know, calculate in terms of a timing perspective. But no, you're right. I mean, if a lot of money comes into a small sector, it would have a hell of an effect. That's for sure.
You know, one of the points that Mike makes is that at one point gold and silver will become unobtainium. So how do you think about, let's say, not necessarily timing it as a trader, but looking at it as an investor, having a larger time frame and thinking about it, okay, well, if I, you know, bought my last gold, let's just take for example at 1850 and it's at 1820 or 1800 today, I can bring my dollar cost average down by buying a little bit more, and with the idea in the back of your mind that, you know, nobody's going to be able to time that bottom perfectly. And you are ideally, if you think about your all-in cost with premiums, you're hopefully going to be bringing that down over time with your proper, let's say, investing versus trading perspective.
I would think, Tom, that averaging down like you're talking about, if you wanted to do that once or twice in futures, we would discourage that because it gets painful quickly because of the leverage. I would leave the listeners in the room today with the idea that averaging up is a lot more profitable and a lot less risky. Averaging as price is going your way.
Totally point well taken, Jim, but I don't you know, I don't think most of our listeners in here, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think most of our listeners in here are trading futures.
I agree with that, but the concept goes the same. If you're buying ETFs, absolutely, you're buying silver stocks, if even if you're buying coins, if let's say that the coin price is going to go from, let's just call it $30 to $130, in my opinion, you'd be better off to get all you could while we're at this price. Waiting to average down might be futile, but averaging on the upside as it's going your way just makes more sense to me, no matter what product you're looking at.
Absolutely. And I think that just the distinction that I'm making is what you do in the meantime while you're waiting for it to go up. You're not necessarily counting on it going down so that you can dollar cost down, but it's just a different way to think about the price action while, you know, we're all waiting for the metals to really take off and do what we're hoping that they're going to do at some point. David, what's your next question that you have on the list?
One that I get often is, how much silver should I buy, or gold? But normally with me, it's silver. So, like, what's the right amount? And you can't really answer that. There is not a one-size-fits-all answer. However, just I've thought about this a great deal. Does it make it right or wrong? It's just opinion. I think for most working people, 100 ounces is probably enough. You know, because you don't need to bet the farm on precious metals. You want to, and you can think of it in many ways. The way that I primarily teach the idea of sound money is that once you go off of a sound money standard, eventually all hell breaks loose and the monetary system fails or is failing, and you need to reset it one way or the other. And every time so far, it's been reset to a sound backing of gold, silver, or both. Will it be different this time? Remains to be determined. But the main problem that I have encountered with investors, especially rookie investors, people that hear the silver or gold story for the first time, is they understand it pretty rapidly. And they realize that all fiat fails and that the destiny to the dustbin of history for the U.S. dollar is probably close to inevitable. But they go all in, or they buy the wrong kind, or the wrong, you know, they buy too much, they buy the wrong type, or whatever. So it's a lot smarter to start small and determine what's right for you. I mean, I could make the argument that, you know, 100 ounces is not enough. You could, but the idea that you go in too heavy. I'll just give you one anecdotal evidence, and that was a guy from Australia, and he was very wealthy. And he went in at, I don't know, $30 silver when it was up there after the 2011 top. It went from the roughly $50 level and hung around 30 for about a year. It was up in, you know, 33, 30, 29, 31. And he really overloaded. And he heard one of my interviews and said, God, I wish someone would have told me, you know, what you say, that you don't need to go all in. Because now I'm upside down. I've got, you know, huge capital loss if I had to sell it, and blah, 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 blah. So that's probably one of the things I get the most. And to add on to that, it's, you know, what has it done for me lately? But I think I'll save that and see if Jim, Bob, or anyone else would like to comment on what I just said.
My opinion is, to my friends that I talk to, and they're probably different, you know, different socioeconomic status than maybe the norm of what makes up society. But I've asked my friends to have 1,000 ounces, basically 2 monster boxes for each adult. If you're single, that would be 2 for the person. If you're married, that would be 4 for the couple.
I like that, Jim, and it sounds like I'm talking about both sides of my mouth. I used to recommend for, let's say, people that are fairly well off, whatever the heck that means, is a bag of silver for each member of the family. But I've ratcheted it down due to, from my perspective, much tougher economic times for everyone. So, but there is no one size fits all. But I like that. I like that 1,000 ounces. And, you know, I'm not saying 100's the right amount, as I already stated, but I would say, unless you're going to get to that level, it's almost like, what the hell's the use? You know, you're not going to have enough exposure to do you much good.
Yeah, one thing I'd probably mention, though, if you're looking at it from an investment or strategic standpoint versus a utilization standpoint, because I think you're probably referring it more as a utilization.
Absolutely, you know, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Versus where you're maybe trying to maybe make some sort of secular bet or trend, you know, maybe a longer term trend. You know, because we see a lot of people will buy larger amounts of metals only because maybe right now strategically or tactically they may be relatively cheaper than other financial assets.
There isn't a better investment. Of course, I am biased, but there isn't anything out there that's so undervalued, that's so well needed. It's not like silver. Silver's in a different class than gold. Yes, they're both precious metals, but you need silver to live, to survive. You cannot have your computer. We couldn't have this conversation without silver. And that's the part that a lot of people get excited about if they understand it. And the vast, vast majority of people have no idea what's contained in their smartphone. All they know is they don't have it. They have a panic attack.
What about the idea of having, you know, a particular percentage of your net worth in silver, David?
Thanks for picking that up. And that's where the argument or the thought goes a little deeper, and it's actually more in tune with what I wanted to say. There's been several studies. I've never found the Harvard study, but there is one from the Ibbotson and Associates has one. Jeff Christian did one. There's another one or two floating out there. And these are what's called portfolio analysis. And this is where you take investment mixes, where you've got stocks, 40%, bonds, 60%, whatever. In all cases, under all conditions, the best mix always includes precious metals. The Ibbotson and Associates study went in kind of good times, bad times, in between times. Their in between number was about 15% to physical metal. Jeff Christian did it from 1968 until I think 2 years ago, and he came out with 25% during that time frame. The Ibbotson study went back further. So the ideal amount is more than what I usually say on a public broadcast, which I usually say 10%, but 15 to 25 is actually the right number. And depending on the economic conditions where I was at the time, I was in San Francisco after the war broke out. And I said I wanted to change what I'd written in the 10 Rules of Silver Investing. That's a published document and I can't change it. And I said 10% was enough. I changed it to 20% and I said I wanted to double it because we were now in a war environment. So thanks for bringing that up, because the clearest picture is a percentage based on what you have rather than is 100 ounces enough. And Bob, thanks for making it clear that that was utility. That's like trading or bartering with it, because will we ever get there? Hopefully not. But if we look at it from a world perspective, it's not U.S. centric. It's not just 5% of the population that lives in the U.S. It's the rest of the planet. If you didn't have silver jewelry or silver coins or some type of barter item in precious metals in Venezuela, you sure as heck wish you would have.
Just a reminder, everyone, just a reminder, if you guys do have questions, we're going to go through a couple of David's points here first, then we'll be taking questions. And if you don't feel comfortable speaking, feel free to just send them to me privately and I can ask them as well. Go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
Okay. I'd like to ask Mr. Morgan his personal preference on what type of silver to buy, whether it's bags of junk silver or if he's got coins, sovereign coins or bars or generic rounds, what he would recommend that people in the room look to purchase. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I still think that when you start, so you're at ground zero, you heard the arguments and you say, well, what do I start with? I still think it's best to start with what's referred to in the trade as junk silver. And that gets back to what Bob said about utility. I mean, when I wrote the 10 Rules of Silver Investing, I looked at it from the worst case scenario. I mean, some of you know and some of you don't. It's not that important to you, maybe, but it's important to me that having an engineering background, I was taught to think logically much more than a lot of other disciplines that you might get educated in. And with that background, we look at any function as an infinite to a zero possibility. So when you integrate a forcing function. You look at it at rest and you look at it vibrating so fast it blows apart. I did that to just build the basis of, so let's apply that to economics. What's the worst case scenario? So rule number one in the 10 rules of silver investing goes something like this. No one wants to be a prophet of doom, but in the unlikely event of an all-out economic collapse, silver will be the money of last resort because gold will have too high a unit value in order to buy gas, food, or whatever. Now, again, that's the worst case scenario. That's doing the function to economics is not functioning or not functioning hardly at all. And what would you do? You would barter. And of course, again, it's not like, well, David, wait a minute. It's like, well, David, it's happened in Argentina. It's happened in Venezuela. It's happened in Turkey. It's happened. And it's taking place right now. Someone's, you know, exchanging some precious metals for something they want or need. So that's it. Start with a bag or, you know, use the percentages. Once that's accomplished, I'm usually more partial to bars. They're easier to stack. They're easier inventory. There's a ready market for any silver product. Bars are really simple. I have it all. I used to buy rounds in the 10 rules of silver investing, so I don't sound like I'm not being consistent. I said be careful when buying coins that you want to get the silver is silver at the sell side. In other words, you don't get a whole lot of premium back on a sovereign coin over a silver round. Will you get some? Yeah. But is it substantial? No, in most cases. Is it substantial right now? Yes, because there's such a backlog of demand for, let's say, silver eagles that doesn't exist, that you're seeing these huge premiums. And I'm not sure when you guys can tell me $8-$9 an ounce. It's crazy. But in the longer term, premiums disappear on the sell side. So keep that in mind. I have different sovereigns because of, one, I can afford them, and two, I kind of like some of them because they're limited editions, meaning they're bullion coins, but they don't mint too many of them, or they only mint them for 1 year. There was some wildlife series that the Canadian Mint did for a while, and I tried to scoop like a box of those. So I think I covered the gamut. I hopefully answered that question thoroughly.
Yeah, and I think it's also, I always joke in the business, when you buy junk silver, don't be surprised when you can't read half the heads or the tail side. They're pretty worn. So just a caution of note, I guess.
That kind of, to me, it adds to the character. I remember I bought a junk bag, and thinking back to, you know, pre-World War II dating on some of these coins, and to think about, again, to really take into perspective how long those coins have lasted and what they might have seen is kind of cool as well to me.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's just one of those things that I always kind of look at it. You know, if you take it to the grocery store and you go to the clerk, you know, if they can't read the the print or the whatever they call it, the coin itself, you know, the imprint or whatever, it's not worth as much as, you know, maybe a newer sovereign coin or something like that. But definitely it's nice to have some recognizable legal tender, that's for sure.
You bet. I'm going to interject a bit of humor here just for what comment on Tom's comment. So I was down at the one, I've been to it several times, was at the Anarchapoco event run by Jeff Berwick, and I usually carry some silver dollars with me at those type of things. So I gave him, and I forget the exact date, we'll call it 1871. So I handed it to Jeff, and I said, this is the last silver dollar that Wyatt Earp used when he bought his last beer. And Benny bought into it for half a second, and I really knew that. But I'm just going back to, as you said, Tom, you don't know where that coin's been, especially the silver dollar market. By the way, just for everyone's knowledge, there is not really a junk silver bag for dollars, for U.S. silver dollars. They are a category all among themselves, and they grade them across the board, but even a what we consider be junk bag of silver dollars will be a much, much higher premium than you would have on a bag of 50-cent pieces, a bag of quarters, or bags of dimes.
Yeah, that's a pretty good comment there, David.
Thanks.
What else do you have?
Well, one of the questions I guess, you know, what do I do? And, you know, obviously I've advocated real money for a long time for lots of reasons. And most people listening to this spaces would know all those things. But the equity side is what I discovered early on in my investing is a good way to get exposure or leverage to the precious metals price without using the futures or the options market, which I've done at all. And what I found is that it works out quite well, especially if you balance your portfolio. So I look at it like I want so much physical, but I don't want it all there because while silver is, let's say, going sideways or going sideways to down and gold's doing basically the same thing going sideways to down, you might have a equity portfolio where a company does really, really well during that time frame. And so your overall portfolio of precious metals looks much better than if you're just focusing on the physical itself. And also, early on when we had, you know, I could do nothing wrong, and I'm just using I as a metaphor, it's the industry. I mean, really from around 2000, you could say 2002 until the top in 2011 for silver in April and the top 2011 September for gold. Gold had an 11-year, year-over-year increase in price. Silver slipped back a couple of years. There were years where silver was the best performing asset class. So during that first decade when I started at the time, the Silver Investor, and I changed it to the Morgan Report years ago, you know, everyone that was in the sector was pretty darn happy. And we had spectacular gains in some of these mining companies. And I took advantage of that knowing that some of them were just overbought substantially and took that profit and moved it into physical metal. So there's a lot to be done, but I really have believed and known my own work and what I've seen with others is that to really get, let's say, a more balanced approach to the market, I really think you should do something on the equity side. And I understand there's purists out there that don't trust any paper, anything, and all they want is physical, and that's fine. I'm free market. If that's what is most comfortable for you or you're uncomfortable getting a stock trading account or any of those things, fine. I have no argument with it. But if you want to look at it from what's the most beneficial to me as far as making the best gains possible with the least amount of risk, I would definitely want to be on the equity side as well as the physical side.
Or the future side.
Well, the futures. Well, let me just comment on that for a minute. When the 2011 hit, remember we discussed what I said early on about the $9 silver? Well, it went from 9 to 50. Well, there was a long, and you can look back, I've been doing this from memory, but there was a channel formation around 19. And when it broke to the upside of that channel, I put out on my premium service what I, you know, people pay me to do. I said, I'm going long and strong right now at 19. And it went all the way up to, I believe you have to look at a chart, you can correct me, but I think it was 24, something like that. And I sold out. So $5 move on a leveraged position is pretty substantial. And then QE2 was announced, and I got right back in at 24. So I had a little bit of slippage, and I rode it right up to the top, and I called the top. And I have people that retired for life on that move because they had enough leverage in at 19 and they sold when I told them to. And they wrote me these nice, lovely emails. I got cards and letters and gifts and chocolates and all kinds of stuff because I called the top on that. But that 19 to $50 move, if you rode that whole thing and you did it with a, you know, you have to use some leverage, but it could be substantial, and it was. And just want to make that comment. I'm not trying to brag. I'd like to see it again. I think it will happen again, but, you know, time will tell. I could be wrong. We'll find out.
Sounds good, David. How do you, again, let's say based on risk tolerance, is that how you would advise people to try to expose themselves to the mining stocks or not?
Well, yeah, I just did an article, the editorial, a few months back, because a lot of our members were asking, well, with the increase in oil prices, you know, food situation and everything else, you know, that obviously is going to cut into the bottom line of the profit structure of a mining company. And we said, yes, we agreed. So we wrote the article on what is the best sector of the mining business. And this has been a stalwart of the Morgan Report from day one. And that is the royalty streaming companies. They have a lot less risk and a lot more upside. They'll balance your portfolio and they'll usually keep you in a profit zone. So we've basically featured a lot of those throughout the years in our top tier and mid tier holdings. And it's worked out really well. So that article going back a few months ago was like, we're not changing. We're just reiterating that the best thing you can do if you really want to make money on the equity side, especially now with the indeterminable future price of oil and energy, you're much better off in most cases with a royalty or a streaming company than you are with, let's say, junior miner, for example. And yet we do them all. We do top tier, mid tier, and rank speculations, but we do them in a unique way and keep people safe if we can. I mean, I can't control what people do with their brokerage account, but we basically start on our speculations with money you can afford to lose. And I think it was Jim that said, add on the way up. And I'm one of the few that teaches that. You're really, really looking for trouble to add to a loser. You can't average down. A lot of people teach it. I don't. I teach not to do it. There are exceptions once in a blue moon, but most of the time it's average on the way up. Add to your winners. Don't add to your losers. Add to your winners. Don't add to your losers.
Yeah, that's an important distinction in the equities versus the metals, right?
Right. Yep.
What else do you have, David?
Well, I think, the idea that silver, gold, but particularly silver, what have you done for me lately? And, you know, so many people, I coined the phrase years ago that silver will scare you out or wear you out. Scaring you out was a reference to the fact that it usually does these big spike lows and it just scares the heck out of people. You know, like call it a bottom years ago. I, again, don't have a chart in front of me, but I've got some of these visualized in my head. I just don't have the dates below the visualization. But regardless, silver, I called a bottom, I think it was 1844, something like that. And it stayed at that low for 1 year. So for 1 year, I was right. For a full 12 months, the low of silver was that 18 and change. And then month 13, it broke down below that. And so I'm wrong. You know, in the longer term, I was wrong. It got to that 18 level on a spike. And it spiked to that level, came right back up and traded around, I'll say 20, I'd have to look. And then it got back down to that level and it broke down below that. And then it traded, you know, in the 14s. And then we all know it was March of 2020 where we got to, I think it was 12 or 12 print on paper. And we had a gold-silver ratio of over like 125-1, which has only happened a few times in recent history. And I was fortunate enough to have some cash aside. I actually called up Bob Coleman and said, Bob, buy me some metal here. And I think I did it the day before the low. I called Bob and I think it was 14 or something. I made my order. And the next day it went down another buck or two on paper. I called Bob back. I said, it looks like I'm off. I'm off. And Bob assured me that, you know, the physical price really hadn't changed $2. And, you know, I'd been a good order and on life goes. But that's the scare you out part. The wear you out part is where it just goes sideways forever or sideways and slightly up or sideways and slightly down. And I get it. I'm an investor myself. I mean, I'm not too fond of them anymore, but Mr. Buffett has said, you know, we eat our own cooking. I mean, I do what I show you is what I'm doing. And so it could be frustrating, and it is. But from a longer-term perspective, silver is still higher than it was in 2002. It's about roughly fivefold increase. Gold has done better percentage-wise, but silver hasn't. You know, sat there at $5 for the last 20 years plus. And I do believe, as I mentioned at the start of this spaces, that when we had that rough spot in 2008, silver was hammered down a lot more than gold, but it also outperformed substantially. And I still do think that's the case of what's going to take place going forward. I'll also just add one more comment, and that is I'm of the belief that the summer doldrums are here for the whole summer. So July, August, maybe part of September. I don't expect a lot of price movement out of the metals. In fact, we probably could hit a spike low in silver. We might hit a spike low in gold. Really discourage the community. And of course, if you have dry powder and you want to take advantage of that to maybe make that last buy, again, I'm talking physical. I'm not talking about averaging down or new investment. I mean, on the equity side, I digress for a minute. On the equity side, there might be a certain stock that's really performed well. And then during a sell-off like that, you might have a 1 or 2 day opportunity to buy it at what we call stink bid or something like that. So I don't want to contradict what I've said about, you know, add to your winners and get rid of your losers, because that's the general idea. But as in most things, there's always an exception here or there. But you got to know what you're doing. I mean, you don't want, if you're going to do that, you want to do it with the bluest of the blue chips that you possibly can, or maybe one of the juniors that you know is going to become a mine, that type of thing.
Perfect. Again, perfect perspective. And that again, needs to, I think, helps educate the audience to show us that we need to think about the difference between, let's say, investing and speculating, right? Investing,
right,
with a, maybe not investing is the right word, but putting money into something with an actual time frame in mind, rather than just putting money in and expecting to have it out right away.
Yeah, I use the word investing. I mean, I actually wrote an article or two on this topic. And, you know, for me, investing means, you know, a legacy. In other words, I bought Franco Nevada at 19. I don't know what it is today, 140. And that stock, you know, pays a dividend. It's not very big. If I use Pan American, I bought it at 250. And I don't have any idea where it's at today, probably up tenfold. And, you know, I got a 1% dividend, but on a 250 stock. So now, at 25, I'm getting, it's really 10% on my downstroke. In other words, what I put in relative to my investment, 20 years later, that stock's paying me a pretty good dividend because the stock appreciation has been so strong over that two-decade time frame. That's investing. But most people don't have the patience to do it, and it's really hard to find, in my experience, those type of investments. You could use Agnico Eagle. You could, well, it's in our top tier, basically. And people say, well, geez, David, I know all those companies. Why would I do it? The reason is you want to make money safely. And those stocks, in my opinion, will trade like penny stocks if we get that influx that Rick Rule mentioned earlier in this conversation. When that 1% goes to 2% and doubles the demand side on the precious metals. I see that Steve St. Angelo is listening. If you don't mind, Tom, I'd like to kind of get his input. He does such a great job on how important energy is to the overall equation, and maybe give him the opportunity in the last 10 minutes. I've got to go, folks. I've got another interview. Just where he's seeing the energy cliff and how many people give this idea that that no, we're high grading these mines and we're really not depleting these mines to what some of us know is taking place, that they're just, you know, doing the mining thing and that we really haven't lost. And we have. We've got a huge degradation in the ounces per ton category, especially in the silver side and gold too. That's obviously, to me anyhow, that we're losing dollars per ton. In other words, the grades are depleting rather rapidly. So if you could get Steve in here, maybe make a further comment, I'd appreciate it.
Grades and margins as the cost of energy goes up. I'm not sure if Steve is on his computer or his phone, but always happy to have him in the room. And we've actually touched on that discussion a couple times with him in the past couple weeks.
Okay.
With that.
Yeah, I don't catch them all, so I'll let it be. Yep. Well, I'm pretty much done. I mean, guess me anything you want. If anybody sent you direct DMs that will have a question.
Financial Argument, you had your hand up for a while here.
join in if you'd like to ask a question.
David, do you feel comfortable giving an update on your favorite stock that you've had in this precious metals sector for the last 4 or 5 years? I don't want to give the name of it. I don't. If you want to give an update on it, that's fine. If you don't want to, I certainly understand. Thank you.
Yeah, now I'll name it. I mean, you're not supposed to do this, especially if you are a registered investment advisor. But I had a young guy that came on board years and years ago, and I said, you should spread out. I think in the top tier, we have about 6 or 7. Pick, three. And I do that monthly. I say, this is the best 3 this month kind of thing. But I told him, start with this one stock, and that was Franco-Nevada. And at the time, I think it was about a $30 stock. And that stock was moving up or down just a little bit, $1.25. And he called me, and he's having a panic attack that, stocks go up and down. And I told him, maybe stock investing isn't for you. I can't give you your stock investment money back, but I can certainly refund the money on the newsletter. We'll just call it good and let it be. Well, I think about a week later, Franco took off. Not like rapidly, not like a penny stock that made a discovery. But, I saw in those days, I had some few subscribers. I kind of knew all of them by name. And I noticed that he renewed. So that company is one I've held for a very long time. I also write options when things get overbought. So I'll have periods of time where I'll tell my premium members, I'm writing calls on this, this, and this, and here's why. And they can follow me in or not, but at least they know what I'm doing. And it's a good way to lower your average price of that given company. I like Franco because they're kind of the stalwart of financing mining companies. They started the idea. They've got a great portfolio. The Midas mine is what made the company. And they also have oil exposure. So they have some energy exposure as well. So, again, I can't say this is the only one to buy, but I do regularly tell my premium members, if you don't own that one, then why not? That's when, of course, people get the idea they want cheap stocks, right? They want to buy. They don't want to buy a $140 stock. They want to buy a 14-cent stock. And as Bill O'Neill said, founder of Investors Business Daily, cheap stocks are cheap for a reason. They're cheap. So not to bash the penny stock world. I live in that world because without the junior mining industry, there wouldn't be Franco-Nevadas. So you got to be cognizant. But to put big money in something as speculative as a 1 in 4,000 shot of that becoming a discovery and actually becoming a mine, you got to use your head. So that's the experience that I've gained over years, and that's what I teach, that's what I do, and that's what I put into the reports.
And again, going back to my discussion with Rick this morning, he said that maybe 1 in 3,000 will answer the unanswered question of what they're trying to explore and actually make a decent discovery.
Yeah, it's debatable if it's 1 in 4,000 or 1 in 3,000, but that's the general idea. The idea is more important than the number. And exactly. And people, especially people that are unsophisticated, they know that the company's drilling, and they think drilling means they're drilling off of a wall of metal or ore, or grade material, I should say, and it's falling to the ground. They're scooping it up, and they're trucking it out, and they're putting it in a hopper, and life is good. Drilling in the junior category really means that they are exploring for metal, if it's there or not. I mean, basically, and I'll say it, and I don't think anyone said this in a long time, but when you buy a junior mining company, you're buying dirt. You are buying dirt, and it's dirt until proven otherwise. But yet, if you tell people that, then, you're negative or whatever. You can call me any adjective you'd like. The truth of the matter is, you're buying a pile of dirt. And you hope that there's enough, economics in the metal, whatever mineral you're looking for. It could be lithium, it could be cobalt, it could be magnesium. I don't care. You just hope that the amount of recoverable material is economically probable for you to turn that dirt into something that's profitable because there's enough real metal in it, relative to the quantity of dirt. And in 3,000 out of one cases, it's not the case. One out of 3,000 or 4,000, it is the case.
Absolutely. And again, just to kind of broaden that discussion, I did do that interview with Rick this morning, and we spent over an hour just thinking about or discussing the right kinds of questions to be asking of junior miners and explorers. So look forward to that. It should be out in the next day or two for those of you that want to listen to that. Okay. David, I know you probably have to get running here, but I thank you for your time. Is there anything else that you wanted to share with us before you do?
No, well, maybe just, you know, I do a lot for free for the general public, and I'll continue to do so. And so if you're interested in just, you know, my thinking, probably the best place is to be on Twitter. I usually post, you know, discussions like this or videos that I do or interviews that I do on my Twitter account. I also cut and paste or post information from, let's say, the mainstream or even the alternative press that I think is so important that someone should read it. You know, I've got Steve St. Angelo and some of the others on, you know, people that I follow, and I kind of get in these grooves where I didn't follow him long enough. I just looked at Steve's account, I think, yesterday, and he had three or four things that I thought were extremely important for people to understand the balance between energy and why precious metals will come to the fore sometime in the future. So, you know, I appreciate all the accolades I've gotten, even the detractors. You know, we're none of us perfect, but I think the main theme here, Tom, is one, thanking you for taking the time for us all, and also education. You can never become too smart. You know, there's no such thing as a know-it-all, and things ebb and flow. You know, there's changes in our society, especially now where it's happening so rapidly and people don't know where to turn. There's so much confusion and censorship and propaganda that it's really refreshing to get a group of people that are willing to tell the truth to the best of their ability to help others. So I'll close with that.
Thank you, David. You know, it's, I always say that I wouldn't have a show without guys like you being generous with your time as well. And to your point of trying to tell the truth as best as you can, you know, having the humility and really the length of career that you have, and where the humility comes in is if you were wrong about something, I'm sure you've admitted it, you've done it, you know, in our personal conversation, said what you've been wrong about. But, you know, as being in this industry as long as you have, of course, you're going to be wrong about some things. But having that humility to know that you can be wrong and admit it is very much appreciated, David.
Well, thank you, Tom, and everyone. I do have to scoot, but I will be back. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time, David.
Thanks, David.
Bob, did you, I know you had posted that chart, and you had posted a couple different things over the last couple days here. Did we touch on that at the beginning?
We did kind of touch on it. We could take questions or try to go down the rabbit hole a little further. It just depends on, you know, how much this bores people, I guess. It's a tough one because when you get into the paper world, there's obviously a lot of accusations and a lot of counter thought that there's maybe malintentions or some type of a malfeasance or something that's going on behind the scenes. But a lot of the stuff is really just Wall Street being Wall Street, trying to skim the public, whether it's an institutional investor or a retail book or you know, some type of broker dealer that's putting out a new product to their client group.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think that's an important point, Bob, because there's just so much of this stuff that, as you pointed out, that ends up losing money over time, and that has to be understood with, let's say, the intention behind it, right?
Yeah, I think the tough part that I kind of see it in this market, it gets frustrating watching just simply the price action, but you're trying to understand what's actually happening behind the scenes to maybe, I think the frustrating part is trying to understand the paper world, only because the paper world has such an impact on the price. And that's what we're trying to always figure out in sort of, I think, with Twitter or, you know, research firms or, you know, guys that watch the physical market and try to say, hey, listen, why isn't the physical going up when there's just obviously a lot of demand for physical? Or you've seen the COMEX and the trend of the COMEX after the big 2020 sort of infusion of inventory into that, into the COMEX and the depositories that service the COMEX. You know, you've seen now this sort of reversal of fortune where metal is now constantly flowing out of the COMEX. So you're trying to understand, okay, what's actually happening there? What does that metal represent? What's the metal represent in the eligible category? What does it mean when SLV has a huge influx of metal going into that or a huge outflux of metal? That's the hard part, I think. Yeah, SLV, I think, starting to understand this more and more with derivatives. There's so many derivatives now that are tied to SLV as a sort of an anchor for price representation. I think it makes it more and more difficult to understand physical movements versus paper products or derivatives that are created to sell to institutions. I think that's what's starting to come to light. And that's the part where I'm trying to constantly try to uncover, you know, what is reality versus what is just simply structured products, whether it's an ETN that's 80% of the funds in a treasury, even though they call themselves a silver fund, you know, that their anchor is a U.S. treasury, to get some dividend yield, but then they just use options or futures to anchor, the portfolio to maybe get some price action. Or you talk about, like we've talked about ad nauseum with these buffered callable notes. You know, that's been a big thing this last, really going back to the fourth quarter of 2021, you saw Wall Street come up with these buffered notes where, they give the institution downside protection of maybe the first 20%, but then they limit the institution to maybe to the upside of about 80%. So they give up on either side a little bit of risk or reward. But I think for the physical guy, they don't care about they would rather have the total exposure to the upside, because obviously what we kind of see is a zero-sum game. And eventually, this idea of all this derivative and leverage activity is going to basically come if the market or the investors start to get wind and say, hey, listen, I'm not really investing in anything with regard to silver. I'm just investing in some paper vehicle. I think that's what we need to kind of educate people more on. Is, hey, listen, if your institution is representing silver in their portfolio for commodity exposure, but they're sitting in one of these Credit Suisse or Deutsche Bank ETNs, it has nothing to do with silver. And that's what I'm trying to maybe get out on Twitter.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm just looking at that Credit Suisse X-Link silver shares covered call ETN that you posted. And since its inception in, that looks like, I don't know, maybe 2013, it's gone, 78% down in value? So as you said there, what is the purpose of this vehicle? And is it just a leveraged bet on a leveraged bet?
Yeah, I mean, I always hate to get too critical, but it gets very frustrating watching this crap that gets put out there for the public to buy when the public doesn't. Most of the public may not even read the prospectus or understand what they're investing in. They just say, hey, listen, it's a silver fund, it's Credit Suisse or it's Deutsche Bank. It must be a big name, so they must have some type of credibility. I'll just buy that fund and I'll get some price representation, not knowing what exactly that fund actually does. And there is, I can understand the need for covered call writing. Like David mentioned, if you're going into a period of time where you're maybe looking at, maybe a tight trading range where the market doesn't really want to go up at all, and you may see some downside risk, using covered calls to sort of provide a little bit of income stream or maybe some buffer to bring some income into the portfolio to maybe help reduce the exposure to the downside. I can see that. But the problem is these ETNs that are designed longer term, it's like these 2X and 3X levered funds, whether on the long side or short side, they're a complete waste of time because you have this roll game in the futures that constantly creates decay And the thing is always going to lose money. And then, of course, you have the volatility premiums and you have, you know, all the pricing that goes into whether these things use options or different volatility factors that create either more decay or, depending on when you get in, if you get into at the wrong time, you're fighting an uphill battle. So it's not like just buying an ounce of silver and say, listen, I'm willing to, for me, buying silver is time in the market versus, you know, a lot of the stuff is just timing in the market. You know, there's obviously some very good portfolio managers that use timing strategies. But I think for most investors out there, especially in the physical metals world, you know, we're more interested on, hey, listen, where is this market going in the next 5 years? Not necessarily in the next 5 minutes.
Absolutely, Bob. You know, and you spend a lot of time trying to educate people, trying to get to the bottom of, you know, products like this. Do you spend any time on the mining equities?
The hedge fund I manage, it's not really in the mining world. I have just a very, very small portion in GDX and GDXJ, and that's only for just basically some exposure just to the mining companies, but it's, you know, it's less than maybe 0.5% of the entire portfolio. Most of my thinking is more on the physical metals markets. My concern going forward, and I think a lot of people share this concern, is that, you know, I look at this thing from a counterparty and systemic risk perspective that, you know, as we lever up, the Fed is going to be forced, you know, into a box more and more where they can only tighten policy or tighten the balance sheet for so long before something breaks. And we've seen this since 2020 or even sooner. I mean, going back to the 1980s, you know, you cannot have, anytime something breaks, they're stepping in much quicker, and the time frame is much shorter. So, so I've read a lot where people are expecting by August this whole thing will just basically, the Fed will be forced to basically shelve QT, and at some point start to figure out maybe some type of structured quantitative easing or some type of strategy to, you know, maybe provide liquidity into the markets. It's interesting because I went into this rabbit hole with this RRP, reverse repurchase program that they've created, and they created that back in 2021, really as a way to create a floor in interest rates so they wouldn't go negative. Well, now this thing has turned into a monstrosity, and you have over $2 trillion sitting in this program. Basically, it's the Fed borrowing money overnight from money market funds is one of the big counterparties. And so people are willing to park their money at the Fed overnight and enjoy a risk-free return rather than going into treasuries or other type of paper. Well, what's interesting is the Fed's balance sheet, you know, they've been buying since QE, you know, going back to 2009, they've had almost a zero interest rate policy, and they bought all this treasuries and mortgage-backed security paper, and their interest rate probably has been coming down in terms of the income that they're receiving from this. Well, they're now raising rates, and the RRP is basically every time they raise rates, that RRP actually increases as well. So it's an overnight rate, but it adjusts with whatever the short-term rate is. And so now you're getting to a point where if they keep raising rates, they're probably, you know, their asset side of their balance sheet, which is all these treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, may not even be yielding as much as what they're paying out on the liability side. I mean, it gets to a point where, and this is where we talk about hypothecation of treasuries and how treasuries have basically become this source of collateral. Treasuries have been monetized as a form of money now with an interest-bearing component to it. But it's now used basically as collateral throughout the system, and it's used, you know, maybe the same treasury used once, twice, three, four times over with different counterparties, just because it's viewed as risk free. But at some point, you know, where does this risk free model start to break if now the collateral has been leveraged up? It's like David was mentioning the bet on the Big Short, where someone makes a bet off of a bet off of another bet, and that's what's kind of happening with, you know, these treasuries being used as, you know, collateral for, you know, different rehypothecation transactions. Yeah, it's a rabbit hole.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, is there's a million different things to kind of keep your eye on, like a million different balls to try and understand with all of these different balls in the air, right? And there's different explanations and ways to interpret all of that information. And that's why I try to get different opinions on the show, because there's so many different ways to look at this stuff. I don't know if you saw, I saw it this morning on Twitter, there was somebody had posted that despite the Fed saying it's starting QT, they're still buying trillions of dollars worth of mortgage-backed securities at the moment. Like, where does that fit into running the balance sheet off and you know, supposedly tightening these financial conditions?
Well, they're not buying trillions of dollars. I think it's, you know, less than probably 20 billion, or it's probably lower than that at this point, because as interest rates start to rise, the mortgage balance, the MBS or mortgage-backed securities don't roll over as fast. So those mortgage-backed securities don't refinance. So those things start to stay on the books like old luggage. And so what happens is, yeah, they have a big portfolio of mortgage-backed securities. You know, I think they're like 20% of the entire mortgage-backed security market that they bought, but they're not really buying much more now. The Fed, even though they've only reduced their balance sheet, you know, $25 or $50 billion, whatever that number is, you know, and they're starting the QT, you know, they've also stopped buying or adding to their portfolio, which in effect is somewhat of a QT in and of itself. Like, for example, you know, they were buying $150 billion a month, you know, this time last year. You know, now that's zero. And so effectively the market has to absorb this new debt that's coming to market. And so, but you may not experience it yet because we're still in this sort of windfall with the Treasury's cash position is still, you know, like $650 billion. But at some point they're going to start coming to market with more debt, which is typically seasonal because their tax revenue flow starts to dry up now because it's, you know, they passed the, you know, April and May and June timeframe. Now it starts to, you start seeing the budget deficits and spending start kicking in. And so as the Treasury comes to market with more paper, that's going to be, and if the Fed's not absorbing it now, and also they're letting their Treasuries run off, that's just more absorption the market has to take in without any type of support. So that's where this sort of QT has a bigger impact. It's at the margin. And this is why you're seeing the liquidity, the volatility in this market is an absolute sign of a liquidity structure there's a lack of liquidity. And that's typically when you see, you know, volatility starting to spike, become the sign, you know, the curves, you know, ups and downs start to become wider and wider. And that's question is, you know, like the spinning top, you know, when it starts to wobble, everything becomes unstable. The question is, how far will the Fed take this wobble? You know, will they stop at 3,500 on the S&P? Will they stop at 3,000? Will it just drop down to 2,500? You know, will we see a 50% haircut before they actually say enough's enough? That's the world we live in now. It's a very structured environment. It's not about earnings and you know, trying to maybe use technical analysis to game tops and bottoms. We're living in the world now where it's central banking activity dictates policy.
So, Bob, you know, when we're thinking about all of that, where do you think that first domino will fall? Like, do you think the credit market's freezing up is going to be the most likely place that we're going to see the Fed start to see something break and need to start acting on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the credit market certainly is seeing a huge impact. I mean, you've had, what, $9 trillion in losses over the last, what, 6 or 8 months, 9 months from the top. But you've only had the Fed reduce their balance sheet $50 billion. I mean, it's the effects are such – they're so broad. And that's the problem with leveraging up and the Fed basically creating all this complacency is – you know, they're thinking that, you know, they can do a little demand destruction. They can, you know, try to reduce inflation with the idea that, you know, they can kill the wealth effect a little bit. And all of a sudden people aren't going to feel as wealthy. So they may not buy that car or, you know, high value good or whatever it may be. But they have no concept or they really have no ability to control the supply side. And that's the part that I think, you know, especially the energy guys out there have done such a great job of explaining, you know, the concept of, you know, we still need to, you know, I think there's only been two or three years in the last like 40 years where you've seen actually a decrease in energy consumption. You know, it's just the idea that we constantly need to grow the economy. And to do that, obviously, you need more energy. And so we haven't experienced, you know, maybe getting smacked in the face when energy, just like with money printing, if energy starts to become an impediment in the markets, we haven't really experienced that yet. You know, yes, inflation could move higher, but I don't think raising rates is going to be a double whammy on people. Not necessarily, it's not going to actually help the markets. It'll just kill the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing, is something that I've talked about so many times on the show now, is how the Fed is trying to get a hold of supply side inflation by affecting, because the only tools they have are demand side, and squashing the demand side doesn't necessarily have the effect that you want it to have to crush the supply side inflation. But somebody I had spoken to in the last couple of weeks was saying that the Fed has seemingly or realistically tightened a lot more than, you know, the 75 basis point and 50 basis point hikes that they've actually made. It's more so about telegraphing to the average investor and to all of the market participants that they're going to be raising rates and doing QT. And that actually has a larger effect on the overall condition of the markets. What do you think of that statement?
Yeah, Lee Adler does a great job of explaining the concept of the Fed raising rates, which is really just a bunch of BS, because the market is actually forcing rates higher. It's not necessarily the Fed just waking up one day and saying, we're going to raise 75 basis points. So there has to be a lot of structure and undertone in the markets to tighten up liquidity and basically to get institutions and behaviorals and behavioral concepts starting to equate to higher rates. And so risk premiums have to go up, and there's a credit risk has to start becoming more of a factor into the markets. These are all things that have to be brought in. You know, the Fed, for example, having all these mortgage-backed securities, and now they're not really buying any more mortgage-backed securities. Well, now the market is forced to take in these mortgage-backed securities. Well, they may not be willing to pay the same rate that the Fed was willing to pay, which was probably a lower rate, because, you know, they don't care about risk premium. They just want to provide liquidity into the market and support some type of narrative or some type of move to provide confidence. So now that the Fed has walked away, you know, the market's saying, listen, you know, to do that mortgage-backed security, you know, we need an extra 0.5% from the borrower, because now we have to worry about the economy going into recession, their ability to repay. You know, this is a 30-year note. You know, these things aren't, if interest rates are rising, they're not just going to refinance, you know, 5 or 10 years from now. It may be sitting on their books for a much longer period of time. So there's more underwriting that has to go into these products, and that hits across the board in everything. And that's the part that the novice investor doesn't really comprehend, that maybe affects the institutional side or the buy side of the market, you know, where they're constantly adjusting for greater risk premiums. You know, when you're talking about credit up in price, you know, with credit instruments, it's basically the ability to get repaid plus your interest, you know, and obviously unless interest rates go down, then you potentially have a capital gain. But those are all factors that go into pricing, and that ends up, you throw that basically into a soup pot and you stir it all around. That's what starts to force the market to tighten up, to start demanding higher rates from counterparties and the government and everybody else, whoever's wanting to borrow money. It's not just simply the Fed just flipping on a light switch saying, hey, listen, we're going to raise it 75 basis points. I mean, maybe they can do that the old school method with, you know, before the financial crisis in 2008 with Fed funds and the discount window and all that kind of stuff. But that went out the window after 2008. You know, we have a whole new regime at this point.
Bob, you're a little light on your spreads. The 30-year, about 3 or 4 months ago, the 30-year rate was about 3.5, 3.625 for a lender to buy a new house. And now it went to like 5.5, then it went to 5.875, then it went to 6.125, and now it's about 5.75, as I recall. So it was a little bit more than just 0.5%, like you mentioned. And that is probably going into the free market, where your concept is right, where the investors that are going to buy this stuff, they're saying, yeah, we'll bid on those 30-year mortgages in a security, but we want five and a half, something like that, instead of three and an eighth or three and a half in the threes. They want fives or sixes now rather than three handles.
Right. Yeah. It's not the Fed that just says it will take everything that you can print. I mean, it's a different world. And that's the part that just trying to express that to people, you know, educate them in this world of finance. There's so many moving parts. I mean, it's a very complex system. And that's why you start to get into all this rehypothecation of treasuries and the idea that U.S. treasuries now, they're more looked at as a collateral instrument than actually a debt instrument, where people just simply buy and hold a treasury. They're used as money. I mean, they're just, these things are used as a way to borrow more money. And it's this idea that that's the part that, you know, as a precious metal investor, I'm like, this is only leveraging up the system that much more to try and keep this game going. And that's why the Fed can only tighten so much before something potentially breaks. And then they have to come back in with some type of support into the market. And I think that's, if you ask me, I think David's kind of right, or mentioned that, you know, we're kind of in this malaise right now in the summer. And I think if you look at the bear argument on gold, the bear argument is that, hey, listen, a lot of people have bought gold since 2020 expecting QE and this idea of money printing. And now that that's over with and they're tightening the market, at some point, that gold crowd's going to relent and get frustrated and liquidate. And that's what the bears are sort of betting on. Whereas the gold bulls are saying, listen, the economy is going into recession. We're seeing cracks in the system. You're seeing, you know, the consumer confidence, you know, falter. You're seeing inflation surveys going up, but you're seeing a lot of things they're creating more instability and more uncertainty. And at some point the Fed's going to relent and turn tide and start to become, you know, maybe take their foot off the brakes, try to provide liquidity back into the markets if their tightening policy doesn't actually work. And so you have this tug of war that's going on, and that's why you're seeing the markets kind of in this real tight trading range, because nobody's winning. I mean, we're kind of in this period where, you know, the bears have been wrong and the bulls have been wrong, because the Fed's just – You're seeing the game sort of play out. That's why I keep saying the metals are time in the market versus stocks are about timing the market. And that's where, you know, a lot of people that buy metals, you know, they're not buying it for the next 6 months. They're really saying, hey, listen, I don't think the Fed's going to be able to keep this tightening bias for too much longer. But hey, if they do it for the next 6 months, that's fine with me, because when something does break and they have to come back into the market, that means confidence is going to go down that much more. That means, you know, you have this potentiality where silver could do what it did in 2008, where it gets crushed and then all of a sudden it just goes up fivefold. And that's the longer term picture I think a lot of us middle guys are looking at.
Thanks, Bob. Anastasia, you have had your hand up here. Ask a question if you'd like.
Yeah. Hi, Bob. I have a few questions. I'm looking at a chart of the last 5 years, and the low point was February 2020, right when Biden was inaugurated. And it went all the way up to, it jumped up. There's a huge spike in August of 2020. And now it's going down again in the last week or so. Silver. And, you know, everybody's saying that there's nothing that you can invest in at this point because the stock markets are crashing, silver and gold going down, crypto's crashing. So a lot of people are really concerned about where to put their money. And the other thing is, as you know, Bob, you've talked about this. If you have bars of silver, like 100-ounce bars of silver, you can't transact with those bars of silver because they're pretty big. So I wanted to just get some input from Palisades and maybe a couple other people, because you and I spoke about this. What is the best thing to do if you're holding 100-ounce bars of silver that weigh, you know, a lot, and you have a few of them? What do you do with those? Just hold on to them or change them into coin? So in case there comes a time when you may have to use them. I had a question about the ups and downs of the silver. What do you think is going to happen? You might have already talked about this. And and my question about the bars. Thanks.
Yeah, I yeah, in terms of the bars, I know we talked a little bit about it. I think the bars, because you got to look at premium structure also, and the last 2 years you've seen this massive premium on 1 ounce product, whether it's sovereign coins, rounds, whatever it may be. And so part of investing in silver is trying to keep your expenses down as much as possible. It's one of the reasons why I'm probably one of the lowest in the industry, or at least on the, you know, for investors to try and to get to invest in the metals. I don't mark this stuff up a lot. It doesn't make any sense to. And so part of this game is, you know, 1 ounce product day, that's great to get into, but is it worth paying $5-$6 over spot versus a 100 ounce bar at $2.30 over spot? You're able to capture more silver initially for your money. And that's, to me, that's part of this equation. David talked about it earlier about, you know, the idea of recapturing premium. You kind of have to go into this a little bit where you're saying to yourself, you're probably, you know, on the safe side, you're going to get spot back in whatever product may be. And you got to go into that mindset expecting that, you know, if you get above spot, that's great. But that's one of the reasons why I kind of promote the best product for the best price rather than a go-to product, because it may not be in the client's best interest to overpay for a silver product just to get that 1 ounce product. I mean, you may see premiums go down as prices go up, and that 100 ounce silver bar could then be swapped into 1 ounce product when 1 ounce product premiums have started to recede, because maybe you're seeing more metal coming into the market. People are taking profits, so dealers are seeing more two-way action. Those are things I think, yeah, it's just something to be aware of. You know, in terms of silver and the stagnation of price, yeah, I think we're just stuck in this sort of malaise with the Fed trying to tighten, and you know, it's the old adage, don't fight the Fed. The issue is the gold and silver market have actually held up fairly well, all things considered, with the US dollar going up as well. I mean, it's odd because with energy going up, you know, so there's been I did this study, or I guess I did this research a few years ago, but on average, roughly an ounce of silver equals about 4 gallons of gas. This was on average going back to 1950. So silver is actually kind of underpriced relative to the 4 gallons of gas scenario, especially, I guess, if you live in California. But that's where the purchasing power equivalent, that's where why we kind of look at gold and silver, is just more of to protect that idea that, hey, listen, it may not go up in price that much, at least right now, but it may hold its value relative to other commodities or other types of assets. And that's I think one of the advantages of physical metal versus the mining stocks in this period where things have, you know, where the market, the general market activity is seeing, this steady sort of decline or sideways action where it just grinds people up. You know, the metals
Bob, sorry to interrupt you, but what I'm really trying to get at is it's not really something you can use now to transact with. Like, I can't go to the gas station and say, here's a 100 ounce bar of silver. Let me have a credit of a certain amount of gallons of gas. I can't really do that right now. So that's the thing. It's not easily transacted. And also, I heard someone saying that at some point, people are going to be scrounging for silver. They're going to be looking for silver in, you know, landfills and stuff. I don't know if that's true or not, but I heard someone saying that it's going to be so rare to find at some point. I don't know if that's true. And also, you'd think that silver and gold would be going up because of what's happening, that people would be buying more. But does that not reflect in the price if people buy more as opposed to selling?
Well, that's part of this discussion on the physical market versus the paper markets that we kind of went through. If you look at the physical market, the industry, and I was a big proponent of trying to say to the industry, you're charging too much premium. You're basically choking off the market and the consumer by keeping premiums as high as they were, especially in April, May timeframes when you started to see maybe people starting to back off. And it happened exactly the same time last year, you know, going into to June when the U.S. Mint was putting out their Type 2 Eagles, the new design. You know, the premiums were so high and people just kind of backed off. The industry needs to do a better job of not trying to squeak every dollar or penny out of the premium as much as just provide product to the market where it gets more people involved. Because talking to a lot of people, they've been just turned off. But, you know, why pay $13 over spot for a Silver Eagle? You know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, those are the things that doesn't provide a good image for the industry. I mean, it's nice to have a dealer, you know, to make money, and always for dealers making money. But when it costs $3 from the U.S. Mint to sell to the distributor for one in Silver Eagle, and then wholesaler sells that same thing for $9.50 or $10 or whatever the number is over spot because they can get it. It's, they're certainly making a lot of money, but it doesn't attract a lot of people to the market. Yeah, it's just like the idea of selling ice after a hurricane or the gas station that has the last tank left in town. They can charge what they want. And that's the part where I think we need to get in order to get the public more interested in the metals, you got to have this thing where it's they have a chance of making money as well.
Could I weigh in for a second?
Yeah.
Okay. I think Anastasia is asking, how can she use her 100-ounce bar? And I guess that what I'd like to mention to Anastasia and maybe some of the others is that if you think of Anastasia, of your whole worth in a series of buckets, maybe you've got a housing bucket, you've got a car bucket, you've got bonds, you've got stocks, you've got silver, and then you have cash. Or you use your credit card to buy the gas, and then you pay it off with your paycheck every month if you can. So rather than think about how do I spend my 100-ounce bar, if you could think about, I bought my 100-ounce bar, let's say at $26 per ounce, and I'm holding my 100-ounce bar until it gets to $45 or $60 or $70 an ounce, then I'm going to trade it for more cash. I'm going to sell it. But that way, you're thinking more along the lines of your silver bucket, your funds that are in your silver bucket where your 100-ounce bar or bars are, is an investment for later at a higher price, if that's why you bought it in the first place. But don't think about your investments like your house. You can't take your house to the gas station. You can't take your bonds to the gas station. You can take your credit card or your cash. So please think about your net worth in a series of buckets and have adequate amount of money or of investments in each bucket, if that helps.
Yeah, that helps a little bit, except that it also depends on how old you are. Like, if you're like 55, you're not going to have a hell of a lot of time to wait until it goes way past what you bought it at. I think the reason I bought it was because I wanted to take some money out of the banks and have it in a safe place that, you know, I'm holding. That was the main reason.
I think that's admirable. I think that's a very wise choice. Then what you've done is you move some of your cash bucket into your silver bucket.
Yeah, but it could be 15 years maybe before, you know, I would be able to use or sell that and use it. You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm just saying.
Well, you can sell it right now. I mean, it's a liquid market. You can sell it. I'm not sure what you paid for your 100-ounce
bar.
Yeah,
it's below what I paid. But anyway, I don't want to get into too many personal things here. But thank you. I don't want to take up everybody's time here. But thanks for your advice.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anastasia. Anybody else have any questions? I think, again, let's say understanding that we're not necessarily buying bars or metals to be used every day as transactions at the gas station, right? David's point earlier was to have some junk silver or some rounds to be able to transact in the event of, you know, something that looks like a financial collapse. And I don't think necessarily he was talking about using it as an everyday, you know, transaction vehicle. And at the same time, we need to not necessarily rely on, you know, that one asset to make up your entire portfolio, as David had also mentioned. But again, just different perspectives for all of these different things to consider and really have in your mind when you do start buying, and not to, let's say, have a particular short-term time frame in mind, because as much as I would and everybody would like to be able to know exactly when silver hits its bottom or its top or any asset for that matter, the market is going to decide that, and unfortunately we as investors cannot. If anybody else has any questions, we can answer some more questions for a bit here, or we can wrap it up for today.
Can I give you a market update, Tom?
That'd be awesome, Jim.
All right. The gold at this time of the day is down $3.25 at $1,821.55. That's basis August futures. And the silver is down 36 cents. It's at $20.82. That's basis September. If anybody has platinum, the platinum is up $5.50 at $905.80. And the palladium is up 60 cents, is trading $1,859.53. And if anybody's got any oil, the crude oil is up $2.17, $111.75.
Awesome. Thanks, Jim. I guess we'll wrap it up here for today. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Thanks to David for providing his insight and a couple of topics that he wanted to go over. Thanks, Bob and Jim, for your insights as well. We'll be doing more of these because you guys do seem to like having a live conversation, and look forward to seeing everybody here.
Appreciate it, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.